Okay, I'm going to take a somewhat different tack, and I won't mention Brahmins or Jains, I promise. But it was, I think, an important beginning to this presentation, is that if we're to understand the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha as an historical figure, we cannot possibly do that without understanding the world in which he lived. The Buddha didn't, as it were, one day become enlightened under a tree and then just spend the next 45 years just telling the truth, but he was constantly engaged with the people of his time. And if you think about it, it couldn't really be otherwise. So his teaching is dialogical, and I'm sure many of you who have read the early texts are aware that people come to him, they ask questions. He sometimes asks them questions. It's very much an engagement with the world of his time. But I think another aspect of this that is equally important to recognize is that what we find when we read the early Buddhist discourses, the suttas, is that we find ourselves suddenly in a world that we as humans can recognize. The world of the suttas is full of the most incredibly detailed descriptions of very ordinary things. We discover, for example, how the Buddha clearly paid a lot of attention to the skills of artisans. It's remarkable how he describes a goldsmith at work, or an elephant trainer, or a wood carver, or a person who is skilled in farming or medicine. And what this shows, I think, is very revealing about the kind of person he was. He was a person who paid enormous attention to the details of the world around him. And as John was saying, with the examples of the Brahmins and the Jains and so on, he didn't just sort of have a neutral, oh, that's interesting, kind of take, but he drew and used in his teaching these very hands-on metaphors for how working people transform the world in which they live. A verse that I find very moving in this is in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, just as a farmer irrigates his fields, just as an arrowsmith fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a block of wood, so does the wise person tame himself or herself or the self. In other words, I think what this points to at a very fundamental level is the Buddha observed how people got things done, how they accomplished their tasks. What I think he admired in the work of these people is the acquisition of a certain know-how, rather than the acquisition of an abstract body of theory or knowledge. And I think this comes down to us today in pretty much all the Buddhist traditions, is the emphasis on the word practice. What matters is not what you believe in or the kind of theories that you've been convinced of by some expert, but what matters really is how you can work with the clay or the flesh or the sheer stuff of your physical, mental, emotional experience and somehow transform it, work it, or to use the images he gives, irrigate it, open it up, allow water to flow, allow something to grow, or how you bring together the disparate elements of your experience in the same way that an arrowsmith brings together the different elements of an arrow to produce something that can be aimed and focused on a target, an arrow. Our life too can become less fragmented, dispersed, and more focused. Or the way in which a carpenter takes a rough piece of wood and then carves it and shapes it, maybe works it with a lathe, thereby transforming it into something of beauty, into something of utility, something that has transcended its initial rough state of just being a hunk of wood. And that metaphor applies to us. It applies to how we work with the materials of our existence, our bodies, our feelings, our perceptions, our inclinations, our consciousness. This is the raw material, metaphorically, that we craft and shape through the kinds of practice that we do. And the world that we enter in the Pali Canon is very much a world that we can recognize like our own. It's quirky, it's complex, it's conflicted, it's uncertain. It has virtually nothing to do with the sort of mythic realities that are evoked in works like the Mahabharata or the great Indian myths. It's nothing like the world you find depicted in the Mahayana sutras that come along several centuries later. Although there are still gods and demons who pop up every now and again, they're more like a kind of Greek chorus on the edge of things that comment on the human, all too human, protagonists and their struggles of the time. When you learn about a king, and I think possibly the king that's most described in these early texts is Pasenadi, the king of Kosala, you don't find the king of the Indian myths. You don't find Arjuna. You don't find the sort of heroic, archetypal, almost caricatured kings. You find people just like us. Pasenadi is overweight. He's internally conflicted. He's constantly struggling with challenges to his authority, and he ends up dying ignominiously in exile after gorging himself on turnip leaves, if we follow the Mula Savastivada version of the story. Instead of leading his army into mighty battles, we find him engaged in inconclusive border skirmishes. Instead of him ruling with unquestioned authority over his people, we see him complaining that his equerries don't respect him and his ministers interrupt him. This is basically the sort of tawdry, fraught political reality that's all too familiar from our evening news shows here in this country. So for the first time in the history of Indian literature, and that's quite a claim to make, because Indian literature is significant, it's large, it's huge, it's voluminous. But for the first time in the history of that literature, the texts of early Buddhism open a window onto an unapologetically human world. Now, it's within that world that we need to locate and understand the figure of the Buddha. The Buddha did not sort of live a detached, privileged existence. He's constantly interacting with all sorts of problematic people. And he's establishing a community that is not just a community of serene, robed, shaven-headed monks. Again, this whole language of monks and nuns is frankly inappropriate to describe the kind of community that he set up. His community was certainly composed of what we call bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, but this, although we translate it as monk and nun, and in many ways, in contemporary Buddhism we find in the world today, such people do in fact behave very much like Christian monks and nuns. But I think it's imposing a later view of what have how Buddhism evolved monastic traditions, that rather than trying to strip away the accretions of historical development to try to capture something about the vividness and the difference that we find in India at that time. Bhikkhu and bhikkhuni just means beggar and beggaress, I suppose.
And sharer.
sharer. Okay, I wasn't aware of that. Anyway, but the point is that these were not what we would understand as monks and nuns. He also had another dimension of his community, which were upasaka, which again is usually translated as laymen and laywomen, with all of the pejorative associations with the word lay, the non-experts, the people who really don't know much about anything. But again, that's not what the word means. The word upasaka is actually linked closely to the word Upanishad. It means the one who sits close by. Adherent is possibly a better translation. Instead of monk and nun, we could maybe just translate it literally as mendicant. And there's a very interesting passage that probably occurs, goes back to a very, very early day, when the Buddha voices his ambition, what it is that he wants to do on this earth. It is to establish a community of bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka, upasika, in other words, adherents and mendicants, men and women, all of whom have an equal responsibility in learning and practicing the Dharma and also interpreting it and teaching it. It wasn't just a group where you had the experts teach the laity at all. But again, that's how Buddhism has evolved into something approximating what we would understand as a religion. There's one passage, this is in the Anguttara Nikaya section 6, where we find a list of 21 householders and adherents, lay people, who are described as having attained fulfillment in the Tathagata, become seers of the deathless, and who go through life, who live, having beheld the deathless. They've achieved a noble ethics and a noble liberation. These, when you look up all of these 21 people, you find that they were businessmen, you find that they were bankers, you find that they were government officials, you find that they were doctors. In other words, people who are actively involved in the cut and the thrust of worldly life, as we might call it. And yet these were people that the Buddha raised up or singled out as people who fully embodied the understanding and the practice of the Dharma in the midst of a very engaged and involved life. Now this too cuts against the idea that you have these renunciant ascetics spending a lot of time meditating in forests and lay people who come along and offer them food. That is accurate in terms of how Buddhism developed in Asia, but I don't think it's at all accurate in terms of describing the kind of community that the Buddha developed. So from this list of 21 people, you get a kind of a snapshot of his principal non-ordained followers. And you can see that his teaching therefore attracted people from the emerging mercantile and ruling classes who were actively involved in establishing the new urban societies that were springing up in northeast India at that time. It's important to recognize that the Buddha lived at a very crucial moment in Indian history, when an agrarian society, in other words, people who lived as farmers, people who tilled the land and lived in fairly small communities, some of which were sort of confederations of different families and clans. And that was a way of life that had probably been going on for at least 1,000 or more years in the Gangetic Plain. At the time of the Buddha, we get this shift out of an agrarian society into an urban society, into a society that is governed by kings who rule over vast areas, a society where people come together in close proximity in towns, where there's a greater division of labor. It's where you have a world both of greater material affluence, but also, I think, a world where people have the freedom to start exploring ideas. You know, what is the meaning of life? The renunciants were not just people out on some high-grade spiritual quest, but were actually people who were able to leave domesticity, to live by begging, and to explore the sorts of questions that we would consider to be the world of philosophy, of ethics, psychology, as John said, that these ideas were enabled by the economic conditions of 5th century BCE India. In other words, the agrarian societies had got to a point where they were generating a surplus of wealth that could then be used to support non-productive members of the society who lived as wanderers and as mendicants. It also enabled kings and rulers to employ standing armies, and this is what enabled the new political realities to come into play in India of that time. Now, I could go on and on and on, but I realise we need to stop. I just want to conclude by showing that a lot of what I've been mentioning and what John was mentioning is not just some theory concocted by scholars and academics that this might have been the case. I think that the lives of the Buddha and many of his followers are given with such extraordinary detail, in which the characters are not stereotypes of particular human tendencies. They're not, you know, they're not caricatures, but these people who appear scattered here, there, and everywhere in the texts are all consistently portrayed each time they occur. And sometimes it's just two or three times. Yet the character will be consistent. In other words, we have a picture of a highly humanized world that is very difficult, in my mind, John might have a different view, for someone to have just concocted at a later date, to have just dreamt up. We know that there are Buddhist texts in which that happened, and they're called the Mahayana Sutras, in which we lose all sense of concrete historicity and we find ourselves inhabiting a sort of idealized, mythologized world where the characters are not people you can really, you know, readily identify as fellow human beings. Of course, there's great wisdom in these Mahayana texts. That's not the point. The point is that they lost, as it were, that sense of immediacy and concreteness that we find in the early texts. Now, fortunately, we have two versions of this story of the Buddha and all of his complex political and social dealings. One comes from the Pali. The other comes from a text that's been preserved primarily in Tibetan, although bits of it exist in Sanskrit and Chinese, called the Mula Savastivada Vinaya, the monastic training texts of the Savastivada school, which is one of the early Buddhist schools in India that used Sanskrit rather than Pali. And these texts were then translated into Chinese and Tibetan. What's amazing is that when you try to sort of reconstruct the detail of the Buddha's life from these two different sources, they pretty much match. They're not word for word identical, but the same characters appear. The storyline is basically the same, and yet one of these traditions, the Pali tradition, was preserved in Sri Lanka. The other tradition was preserved in what is now Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, in northeast India, geographically separated by about 1,000 miles. Temporarily, in time, two communities that had no contact for probably 200 or 300 years. And yet, when you compare their respective records and stories, they pretty much match. And I'm going to give you an example. We'll end on this. And this concerns the death of a man called Mahanama, who was the Buddha's cousin and the person who took on the role of the chief of the Sakyan clan in the wake of Gautama, or the Buddha's departure. In other words, he did the job the Buddha might have had to do had he stayed at home. We get an enormous amount of detail about this man, Mahanama, and yet I suspect many of you in this room have probably not even heard of him. Very important figure, a key lay follower of the Buddha. Now, when you look at the ways in which these two respective traditions describe his death, I think we can get a good glimpse here of the similarity but the difference. I'll read them out. We don't need to do the background too much, but basically Mahanama was the chief of Sakya, and towards the end of the Buddha's life, Sakya was invaded by the armies of Kosala under the king Vidudaba, and the Sakyans were massacred. And Mahanama responded to this in the following way. This is the version that comes through the Pali. Mahanama thought to himself, if I refuse to eat with the king had invited him to eat, he will kill me. That being the case, it is better for me to die by my own hand. So taking down his hair, remember he would have had a top knot or something, he knotted it at the end, thrust his great toes into his hair, and plunged into the water where he'd gone supposedly to bathe. That's one text. When we go now to the Tibetan version, the version that's preserved in Tibetan from a Sanskrit source from North India, this is what they say. Filled with anguish for his people, Mahanama went down into the water of a pool. On the edge of the pool grew a sal tree, the branches of which fell into the water. They got entwined in his hair knot so that he was pulled under and drowned. Now, what this example shows, and I could have come up with many other examples, is that clearly these two narratives, separated by 1,000 miles and hundreds of years, are referring to the same story. The details vary, but they must both be referring back to a common source, a story that therefore would have been known in India probably up until about the time of Ashoka, which is about 150 years after the Buddha. After that, the Pali tradition headed south. The other traditions remained in the north. But to me, this is a fairly compelling piece of evidence that this story is not just a myth, that it actually is based on what may well have taken place in the human life of this man, Mahanama, what happened to the society of the Sakyans, and the tragedy that befell them, and the sacrifice that Mahanama made to give his life. Now, when we piece together all of these fragments of specific detail, what's remarkable is that they all hang together in a coherent way. And I think it's very unlikely, if not impossible, that this was somehow concocted at a later date. As I mentioned, when you get to sutras that were concocted at a later date, you don't get anything like the level of detail and concreteness. Instead, you get these rather vague, mythological type stories. So a lot of my work over the last years has been trying to reconstruct the historical version, or what has probably got the greatest claim to being the historical version of the Buddha's life. And in doing this, in meditating on these people and what they said and what they did, you find yourself inhabiting the physical world of the 5th century BCE, largely in northeast India, with all of this context going on. And frankly, this brings alive the Buddha as a thoroughly human person. As with John, I feel that he was arguably one of the world's great geniuses, one of the most extraordinary examples of what a human being can become. And here we have, I think, a lot of material that can allow us to enter into his world, and in doing so, to understand the Dharma as a response to that world, as an interaction with that world that still can speak to us just as powerfully, I feel, today. Thank you.